sound.
C. K. K.
U.
T. T. 90.3 FM.
Upsetting the footing of those who've been traditionally
another reliable communication
able to speak
channel.
And be listened to without either being challenged or without more competition for even just airtime.
When you break out of the role you're expected to perform, you can get attacked in digital spaces. Problem is that the role is so narrow for women and gender diverse people, many are attacked for even existing. I'm Andrea Gunraj from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating, messaging, and meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, or two-spirit trans or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. The Commissioner for Human Rights in the Council of Europe says just speaking out about issues online, often when related to feminism, gender equality, sexual abuse, or specific aspects of women's rights, such as sexual and reproductive health and rights, may be a trigger for violence and abuse. The goal of this violence, says the Organization of American States, is to create a hostile environment for women in order to shame, intimidate, denigrate, belittle, or silence them by means of surveillance, theft, or manipulation of information, or control of their communication channels. No wonder then that almost one-third of people in Canada are hesitant about using social media or taking part in online discussions due to harassment concerns. We all lose out when women and gender diverse people are silenced. Hostility, attacks, shunning, belittlement, and unsafety hurt some people more than others, but that's the thing about abuse. It has a way of spilling out and chilling everybody, making our world worse for everyone in the end. Over coming months, we're delving into this with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every single week. We talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We offer practical tips to help you in your digital life, and we talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. Today, we're with Sarah Soberai, professor and chairperson in the Department of Sociology at Tufts University and faculty associate with the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. She's an expert in U.S. political culture, extreme incivility, digital abuse and harassment, and the mediated information environment. She's author of several books, most recently, Credible Threats, Attacks Against Women Online and the Future of Democracy. A note about content, this episode addresses gender-based violence.
My academic interests have to do with voice and visibility, specifically political voice and visibility, and how that's shaped by interventions with the media. So how the media might make some voices more or less visible or audible publicly. Personally, I love everything from baking to art to cards. I play an awful lot of cards and even improv. I enjoy a number of different activities.
What have you learned about the way gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse plays out? What's the root cause of this?
There's a few things that I noticed about it that I feel like can get lost in the broader story. One is that when women, who were the focus of my study, when women are attacked, they're attacked on the grounds that their very identities are unacceptable. So it's their perceived, because often it's perceived wrong, but it's their perceived race, gender, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, etc., that are the central basis of condemnation. So that is the problem. And you can hear that in the abuse, the way it sounds. So if I think, because I am often looking at people who are politically vocal or talking about social issues. If I think, for example, of the Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris, her race and gender are frequently invoked. There'll be gendered and racialized epithets, certainly stereotypes about the identity groups to which she's perceived as belonging, sexualizing comments, etc. Another noteworthy feature about the identity-based abuse is that although it is intimate and ad hominem, the attacks are also simultaneously generic. If someone is calling you a skanky whore, that feels very personal, of course. But what you notice quickly is that the attacks are actually impersonal in that they could essentially be lobbed at anyone from your social location. So you might look at something terrible that's said about Kamala Harris again and find that that same exact insult, if you took her name out, could be used against any other woman of color in a particularly visible space. So it's this non-specific misogyny that's a red flag. Again, there may be religious or racial, ethnic cues, these sorts of things, certainly. That sort of variation really reminds us that although that abuse looks and feels like bullying, like interpersonal bullying, the rage is much more structural. It's actually rooted in hostility toward the voice and visibility of individual speakers as representatives of a group of people.
You talk about digital hate and abuse as patterned resistance against growing visibility of women and gender diverse people online. Tell us more about that. Why is it so important to understand this patterned resistance?
We tend to hear people talk about these phenomenon, even when you're talking with a coworker or a friend about their experiences, but certainly also in the headlines, as though they are individual problems or personal issues rather than sort of patterned resistance to voice and visibility of specific groups of people. And the reason that this matters, that we understand that it's actually resistance and anger that's against entire groups of people, is that it helps us to understand why the attacks are unevenly distributed, why women tend to get so many more, and why they're unevenly distributed even among women. The abuse is unusually burdensome for people with three sort of sets of attributes. So the first is that women who are members of multiple marginalized groups. So if you're a woman of color, you're going to be blessed likely with racialized gender-based attacks and race-based attacks in addition to the kinds of harassment that white women might experience. Or if you're Muslim, Jewish, or a member of another religious minority group, you're going to find sort of additional layers of hostility. Another group of women who are particularly targeted tend to be women who challenge or complicate realms that are male dominated. So that might be if they're active in speaking about gaming, technology, science, politics, policy, law enforcement, military, sports, right? Any sphere that we think of as male dominated or that has typically been male dominated, there is more anger and hostility directed at those women. And then the third category of people who tend to receive a particularly heavy dose of abuse are feminists or people perceived as feminist or women who I came to start thinking of as otherwise non-compliant with gendered expectations. And the non-compliance can be a pretty low bar. You don't have to do a lot to be non-compliant. So it might be someone who's overweight and body positive or comfortable with their appearance. It might be a woman who's simply in a position of power. It might be a woman who's open about enjoying sex. And of course, you can be in multiple of these categories, right? So if you think of someone like maybe Anita Sarkeesian from Gamergate, you know, who might be someone whose abuse people are familiar with, even though it's now been almost a decade since that really came to our attention. You know, she was sort of at the intersection of those spheres. She's writing and gaming, perceived as feminist. Her ethnicity was often misrecognized, but people would pull into account their sort of assessments of her. The hatred that's there is really a visceral response to these women as destabilizers. And they are, by the way, destabilizers whether or not they intend to be. So if you are a woman writing about policy or science or tech, that your very presence, and even more so if you are a woman of color, and certainly if you're a feminist, So if we haven't had to, and I say that in air quotes, if we haven't had to listen to the voices of Black Muslim women or trans women, maybe, or Black trans Muslim women in gaming, the venom that's coming is really emerging from, I think, an unsettling and often subconscious sense that these long taken for granted social hierarchies might be shifting, right? That it might be upsetting the footing of those who've been traditionally able to speak and be listened to without either being challenged or without more competition for even just airtime. Because if you've been benefiting from inequality by being able to hold the floor more often or hold more sway in conversations, especially if you're someone who perceives the inequality as meritocratic, right? It's understandable that a shift toward access or inclusion or equality might paradoxically feel like injustice instead of more openness, right? Because now you're sharing the floor. But if you perceive that floor as something that belonged to you in the first place, it doesn't feel right. And I do think, again, that this can also be subconscious, just sort of the sense that why are people listening to, I don't have to listen to you, that kind of thing.
What's the impact of pattern resistance on those who are targeted most?
If I think strictly about the personal, and I don't want to suggest if I sort of separate it from the social, which isn't entirely easy for me, but at the personal level, and not talking about me personally, but the women who I worked with in my research, many of them struggle with mental health, for example. There are women who have experienced PTSD as a result of the intensity of the attacks or the frequency of the attacks. A lot of them have faced economic disadvantage or consequences as a result. Maybe they've had to hire bodyguards, or maybe they need to take Ubers when they would have normally walked, or maybe they need to do things like hire a reputation management firm to clean up things that are online. But there are also the more subtle reputational harms that can happen. People also that I spoke with struggled with just social ramifications. People, a lot of what is said about women online is defamatory, it's hurtful, can be stigmatizing. It sort of complicates their lives. And I will say, in terms of women's ability to cope, one of the things that I think is most important and often also missing in the conversation is that your ability to manage an onslaught of sort of vitriol online, especially if it happens over a period of time, is also shaped by your privilege and position. So if I even look at the examples I just gave, if you think about whether you have the luxury of, for example, hiring that reputation management firm, another thing women do will be outsource their social media management. They have somebody else literally looking at and working through the comments and the abuse. But also, if you are someone, so to use my probably safer on air but still unpleasant example of skanky whore, if someone calls a faculty member, a senior faculty member at Harvard University, a skanky whore, that would not feel good. It would not be good, but it's probably not going to be overly damaging if she's established with a reputable, a well-known institution and has a body of work behind her. For women who are new in their careers, defamatory things that are said about them online, cruelty that things that are said about them online can really, really be very, very damaging. If you're a freelance journalist, for example, right? Journalists are dealing with an enormous amount of hate online. If you're a freelance journalist just starting out, or even, a new staffer who has a permanent position, these kinds of things are said about you. It can cast doubt in complicated ways. If you are, say, a Latina, and the abuse that's spread about you, the comments, the hate, the doctored videos, if that maps on to existing stereotypes about your racial and ethnic group, then they are perceived as more believable and more plausible, right? It's going to have a bigger impact.
How about the impact of pattern resistance as a group, as a society even? How is it shaping us, whether we're fully conscious of it or not?
Of course, the threat of unwanted sexual attention in particular and violence has always constrained women's use of public space. If you think of things like the fear of sexual assault that looms over women when they're alone in nature, when they're maybe in an elevator, a parking garage, public transit, maybe on college campuses, right? So the fear of sexual assault, the sense of vulnerability and embarrassment, humiliation that come with street harassment often, or the landmines that are presented by sexual harassment in the workplace. So these are always things that have shaped the way women use and feel comfortable using public space. Literally decades ago, a geographer, Jill Valentine, studied the way women felt about and used physical public spaces. And what she found was so interesting. She noted that women were constrained by what she called these mental maps of the public spaces that they used that were shaped by their fear of male violence and unwanted attention. So they had pretty elaborate thoughts and codes about where they could go with who at what times, you know, under what circumstances. And when I'm listening to victims of digital abuse and harassment, it is clear that just like that threat of sexual intimidation and assault constrained where we go in physical spaces, digital abuse is creating a climate of fear and self-monitoring that mirrors those calculations that women are making when they go out into other public spaces, right? It hovers over the keyboards of the women that I work with. I mean, some of them, as this begins to accumulate, for some of them, they left their preferred social media platforms altogether. Some took lengthy breaks to sort of recover from fear, frustration. Some wrote under pseudonyms or used male avatars. Almost all were engaged in some sort of self-censorship, even if they wouldn't define it that way. What I would see as self-censorship, where they are choosing very carefully about what topics they will and won't write about and where they'd like to publish them or are comfortable publishing them. And this is especially true when the issues they want to address are controversial or their point of view is unpopular. Those who are most marginalized, they may be often bringing new points of view to bear or saying things that are in fact unpopular, if for no other reason than they're unfamiliar or difficult to hear. It is difficult and it is scary, and they are weighing their choices carefully. I think we are all already being impacted by identity-based abuse and harassment, and I'll keep it to just, you know, three or four ways that it's shaping the social landscape, particularly around democracy. But the first of which is, and it sounds very maybe romantic at this point, but, you know, a robust democracy is built on political discourse where people, including those without power, can discuss even the most sensitive topics, abortion, guns, immigration, right? Share their ideas, experiences, and opinions freely. And when we lose those voices, right, if we lose those voices and when we lose those voices, there are both policy implications, right? If we don't know, it's difficult to figure out how to approach different issues if we don't know how they affect people differently, right? And it also has epistemological implications about what we're even able to know. If we don't know what the experience is like for, say, recent immigrants, right? It's very difficult to process and think about the things we contend with, right? One of the key components of the abuse and harassment is disinformation. So attacks on whether you're talking about female journalists, public intellectuals, activists, people running for office, etc., they're riddled with made up information that casts doubt then on the reliability of news, often on scientific findings, on proposed policies, on the integrity of the speakers. If we cannot trust, or we begin to lose all trust in journalism or all trust in people who are running for office or trust in information more broadly, that's a real problem. A democracy is only legitimate to the extent that we have the ability to make informed decisions on our own behalf when we vote. And if we don't have quality information, or we cannot discern reasonably generated information that's been produced responsibly from information that is garbage, we're not able to do that the way we need to. Totally connected to the point I just made is that journalism itself is suffering. Female journalists' self-censorship is not limited to the personal opinions that they share. It impacts what they cover and how they cover it. And this came up repeatedly in the interviews that I did, where a woman would tell me, oh, I will not even touch a story on sexual assault, or I'm not even going to touch a story on this topic that we're talking about. I don't want to write about this. It's not worth it. And then the last way I'll mention is what we can think of as the pipeline problem. If you are on the sidelines and you are a young woman or a person from another marginalized group, and you're looking on and what you see are that activists, candidates, women in office, advocates, public intellectuals, right, are treated this way, it becomes pretty clear that political involvement and activism are high-risk endeavors that are probably best avoided. We do not need to lose a big chunk of valuable minds to the pool of possible people doing public service work. The senior journalists that I speak to say, I sometimes don't even know what to say when young women ask me about going into journalism. I don't know if I would do it again.
You've been doing this research for a long time. Do any findings shock or surprise you?
It almost makes me feel choked up as I think about it, but I think it is making me a little choked up. I think it's difficult to convey how ugly and hurtful the harassment and abuse is. And even when I give sort of academic talks on the topic or try to write about the topic, propriety and a number of other things make it very difficult to share what it looks and sounds like. A number of the participants had the experience of someone doctoring images or videos from fairly gruesome, like torture-based pornography with their likeness in it, and for others, just even more, you know, mundane pornography. I remember one woman who said, and this is not a direct quote, but essentially what she was saying was, I know it's not me, and the people who know me know that it's not me. You know, it might not even be a very good editing job, but it feels like it's me. It is still humiliating. And so when someone takes that, puts it out into the universe, and you cannot, as we know, right, you can't really get that cat back in the bag because of the way digital technologies function. When that happens, it's really horrible. If someone's making rape threats, which are incredibly common, they're often not only very, very violent and graphic, you know, it's descriptive, but they will often also invoke their identities. It's ugly, is my point. So I think the other thing, though, that remains shocking is just how damaging it can be to someone's career, to their life, to their mental health, their physical health, their well-being, that a person's life can change in a matter of days as a result of a particularly intense or well-coordinated attack. And it may be years in the making to get back to a place where they feel safe and comfortable. I have women in my study who, there's a woman who changed her name and left the country. I have a woman in the study who's had to work with bomb sniffing dogs to check for IEDs when she goes to give talks, right? These are unbelievably damaging when they are severe. And I want to say also that in a way it's a paradox. When we attend too much to the severe ones, we do also run the risk of normalizing more routine, what has become disgustingly routine abuse and harassment and hostility. So it is not uncommon for me to have the experience of being at, when I was doing this book in particular, being at a social event, somebody asking me what I work on, and I say, I'm working on, you know, abuse, harassment, hostility online. And they'll say, oh, I've been really lucky. And they might say, I mean, I get called a bitch and a slut, but I've really not had a problem. So to have that sort of normalization, it makes it feel as though it is not okay, or maybe it's overreacting to complain or to say something. For a lot of the women that I work with, and I think a lot of women in general, the abuse and harassment is coming in the context of their work environment. This is a new terrain, I think, for a lot of employers, that when you are asking someone, and let me say, you might be asking them directly, like say you need to be on social media promoting your articles or promoting your campaign, or it can be indirect, where the metric of the quality of someone's work is how many views it's gotten or how many click-throughs, right? If you are in any way incentivizing their public voice and visibility, you have to recognize that that experience of being public is going to impact the people you are employing very differently based on who they are, the work that they're doing, and where and how widely they are seen.
Can you share solutions you think will help those who are targeted, maybe when it comes to platforms and policies and systems?
It is a really difficult problem because that sort of language processing tools, automated detection, is notoriously weak at getting meaning and satire, irony, education, right? It's very difficult. You can, yes, create a bag of words detector, but that's going to not work. And it's not going to work well, and it's going to over-select and these types of things. But what we have going on now is interesting in that it's almost hard for us to remember, but initially we worked more online from a model that was, I'm going to say something, it's going to be filtered and then published, is the way Clay Shirky would talk about it. You know, you're going to go to a comment section, it's going to go into moderation on your news story or whatnot, and then it's going to be published. Now we are at a publish then filter. You know, it is sort of flipped. So everything goes out on most platforms. For something to be attended to, it needs to be flagged or reported, or, you know, it depends on the language that they use on a particular site in order to even get reviewed. And the problem with that for those who are targeted is you can't unsee or unread, right? It's already sort of out there in the ether. And the idea of reviewing everything, you know, going back to a filter first, then publish model, at the scale that we're at, I get that that might not be reasonable, viable. I also would not want to be the human being that does that work, right? There's a ton of great research on how difficult and damaging it is to be a content moderator, but that's a separate conversation. But I think that there are a couple things that would be reasonable asks of platforms. If someone has been targeted or is a likely target, say they're running for office, right? I think it is in fact reasonable to ask tech companies for some stretch of time, whether it is a week, whether it is 2 weeks, you know, it's going to depend on the circumstances, that anything that is, again, it depends on the platform, but directed at that person does in fact get filtered first and then published. Yes, it would be expensive, it would be difficult, but I think it is an in-between, at least that would be something that would help. Another thing that would really help is if there were a probationary period when you made a new account. When someone's being attacked, if an account gets, you know, sort of banned or blocked or suspended, it is very easy to just create a new account, even to do that through automated procedures. If you instead had to earn your way out of, you know, sort of a probationary period, so that for some period of time or number of posts, everything you wrote went through the filter, then publish model, and then you earned the right to then speak without first being filtered. Again, to me, that seems an in-between that is asking a lot of tech companies, but that would be not the same as saying, okay, you've got to sort of monitor everything all the time, which I don't think is reasonable. Again, it's not going to address the crime thing, but if we had an advocate assigned to someone when they've been the victim of online abuse and harassment, in the way we have someone assigned often if they're the victim of, say, sexual assault, that person could at least support the target or victim by helping to answer the questions. You know, what do I do? The questions, because I get them, the questions are predictable, right? Can I get this taken down? Where do I report this? What am I allowed to do? You know, who can help me? So people who understand and can respond to the problem can give them the tools and direct them to the places that can be the most supportive, and to at least recognize that although we don't have a law, perhaps, to go after the people who are doing this to you, in many cases, we do have some ways to support you as you navigate this very difficult space that you're in. Because the police will say, often, well, let us know if anything happens. And so they privilege physical harm above all else. There is real harm that happens when your reputation is damaged, when your mental health is damaged, right? There are harms there that are not sufficient to really sort of respond to in the eyes of law enforcement. I feel in a sense like the female journalists who are more senior who I talk to, I don't really know, like people will ask me, what advice do you have for academics who are writing about sensitive or controversial, polarizing topics? I'm loath to give advice. I don't want to tell people don't do it. And I don't want to tell people you have to just sort of soldier through because it's pretty unpredictable. There's a sort of randomness about it that's striking. You know, you can have one person writing about very controversial content in a highly visible way who deals with some, you know, a little bit of negative blowback. You can have another person with perhaps even a slightly smaller audience writing in a similar way about a similar topic who becomes the center of attention for the wrong group of people, and the effects can be devastating.
All right, now what? Check out Sarah Sobereye's book, Credible Threat, Attacks Against Women Online and the Future of Democracy, published by Oxford University Press. Get the facts on gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on CanadianWomen.org. While you're there, read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show notes to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for your tireless support.
Have you ever wanted to write a book about your life, create a book out of stories you made up for your children, or create a great piece of fiction? Join us on Monday, November 6th for Publishing in the Digital World. Three Black literary creatives will tell us about their experiences creating books in today's digital era. Editor Blossom Tom, with self-published author Rowan Flowers, and publisher Latoya Belfon will be in conversation at the Jam Arts Center, 4065 John Talon West. Reserve your free ticket at eventbrite.com/publishinginadigitalworld or call 438-507-9258. That's Publishing in the Digital World, Monday, November 6th. Join us.
Vous écoutez CKUT.
We're activists, we discuss social justice, and we see comments on almost, I mean, I don't think we've ever had a video where there hasn't been hate speech.
Digital hate, harassment, and violence hurt so many women, girls, and two-spirit, trans, and non-binary people. Content creators who address gender justice, like Emma and Flowley, have a lot to teach us about it. I'm Andrea Gunrach from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What? A podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating messaging and meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, or two-spirit, trans, or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. One in five women experience online harassment in Canada. Younger women are amongst those who face higher risks. 44% of women and gender diverse people between 16 and 30 are personally targeted by online hate speech. Those most at risk include people with disabilities, 2SLGBTQIA+ people, Indigenous women, and Black women. Gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse happens every day. It's pervasive, urgent, and growing. Over coming months, we're delving into this with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every single week. We talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We offer practical tips that will help you in your digital life, and we talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. Our guests Florence Olivia and Marie Emmanuel are internationally renowned researchers and speakers in violence prevention and intervention. They are public figures and experts in human rights and have acted as consultants for businesses, nonprofits, public sector organizations, and governments. They created their own online platform, the CIS, which engages thousands of people from around the world on current gender justice issues. In 2022, they were recognized as two of the 15 most influential people in Quebec. Amongst their work on social media, they've helped spread the Canadian Women's Foundation's signal for help to their audiences as a tool to help end gender-based violence. A note about content. This episode addresses gender-based violence.
I'm Marie Emmanuel, and you can call me Emma for today. That's perfect. So I'm a PhD candidate in law at Queen's University, and I'm specializing in intimate partner violence, primarily on the public space where laws are made with policies and all of that to create a safer place for women in their home and outside of it.
And I'm Florence Olivia. I'm the older sister, and you can call me Floli for this podcast. I'm a PhD candidate at Durham University in the UK, and I'm specializing in sexual violence. My research project is about redefining rape in the law. We also have a platform, an educational feminist platform called the CIS that we started 3 years ago.
And so we now have a community of over 400,000 followers from all around the world. And we're really proud of this. And we're really happy to see that so many people want to educate themselves on feminist issues and women's rights. And through this platform, we have been able to share and democratize our research, which is sometimes hard to reach people who are not necessarily in this sphere.
We've had the chance to collaborate with phenomenal organizations such as the Canadian Women's Foundation, the United Nations for Women. And so we're just very grateful to not only have this amazing community of feminists and activists, but also to really be able to make a difference in the lives of women and girls everywhere.
Our platform is called The CIS, so we're sisters, obviously. That's what, of course, we're passionate about our work. We're passionate about helping women from all around the world. But also we have been dancing for almost 18 years semi-professionally, both of us. Always been almost working together and having fun together. So that's really something that's a big part of our lives.
We both started when we were 3 years old. Yeah. Both of our parents were dancing. Our dad used to do breakdance. Our mom was a ballet dancer. And so it was always part of, you know, just growing up, we saw our parents dance. But we never thought, you know, like when we started our platform, the CIS, we actually, it was at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And, you know, TikTok was really big on the dancing part. Yeah. And so for us who were stuck at home, you know, we tried to, you know, put a message on these dances that are trending on TikTok. And this is really how the CIS started. Yeah. We used to do the dances that were popular, that were on the algorithm, and we added feminist ideas, feminist messages, and it's really how we started, you know, getting people invested in the work. So I think dance is really was at least a big part of our lives growing up, but we never thought that one day, you know, as later academics, we would combine dance and knowledge.
Yeah.
What's been your experience with gender digital hate and harassment as your platform grew?
When we got into, you know, social media and all of that, it was a first for us. So we didn't really know what to expect. We were just doing this out of really interest and passion. So we didn't think really about maybe negative, not repercussions, but negative comments or anything. We were just, for us, it was just natural to talk about these issues. started to receive hateful comments. And when your platform grows so quickly, there's many kinds of people commenting. And yes, there are feminists, but yes, there's also people who have never heard of feminism or who are against it. For us, it was really challenging in the beginning. I mean, of course, it still is, but really it was a shock for us when we started. You know, nobody prepares you for this kind of hatred. And I couldn't understand where that was coming from. Like, we're just really discussing lived experiences of women and what they're going through and these real issues that affect people. And to receive hate because of that, I just couldn't understand. And so it was very difficult to grasp.
Also, a big part of why we were shocked is that we publish and, you know, educate based on data, based on science, based on, you know, reliable sources. And to see that despite the fact that we had evidence about, you know, violence against women, sexual violence, the prevalence of it, it was still met with a lot of resistance, with a lot of backlash that, you know, false or they were lies while we're even providing the sources for people to just have access in an easy, free and accessible manner. That was, you know, a big part of why we were shocked, but also not so shocking to see that women and girls have their voice always censored in a way, whether that is in the public space. So now that this growing age in which we are in about, you know, the digital age, it's not surprising to see that women and girls are having their voice taken down and, you know, that they are trying to be silenced. Unfortunately, we are threatened, you know, whether that is for our own safety, whether that is for our page, or whether that is just for our followers who are trying, you know, to educate their other friends and who are also receiving threats. To see that is just a reminder of the violence that is pervasive, whether online or offline.
We try to just block as much as we can. These are just the steps that we try to take and to preserve also our mental health, is to just not always look at all of our DMs and try to just separate our work from ourselves, which is difficult to do. But we don't feel bad when we block people who are not good for our mental health or not good for our safe space in our, on our platform, because we want to keep this space also safe for our followers.
And you've had the irony of platforms flagging your content on gender justice sometimes, right?
TikTok and Instagram, oftentimes we have our videos taken down because we address these issues and our videos are censored or they're taken down. But then we see these horrible videos of these people and it takes so much for them to be taken down or removed or anything. And that is very disturbing to us.
Yeah, that, you know, as a platform, educative platform based on data research, that we are, you know, sometimes considered as hate speech while we are promoting gender equality. It's still reminders of, you know, the work that remains to be done. And these different social media platforms should actually, you know, contact and discuss with for example, us, you know, survivors of digital hate, so that, you know, we can share our lived experiences. Platforms have a huge responsibility to promote a safe space for all these creators.
Like other creators we're talking to, your content is about feminist education. It's a good example of the positive elements of social media that can get lost.
I mean, the main point is that we can reach the whole world, which we didn't have access to. This kind of fourth wave of feminism, which is that we can finally all women and all gender diverse people can share their own experiences and be like, oh my God, you lived this as well. I did too. How do you deal with that? What can we do as a worldwide community to create change and to have safe spaces and all of that? I think for me, that's the whole point of social media, is that we can reach everybody.
Yeah. And at the same time that we actually also give a voice to everyone. For example, that is something we do with Desist. We often ask, you know, our followers, did you have any experience of sexual coercion? Then we get answers from people from everywhere around the world who live under different legislations, but that actually can connect with other people from other countries and see that, you know, their lived experiences should be recognized in the law, or that these different forms of gender inequalities are still pervasive in 2023. Oh my God, say it. In 2023.
What do you suggest someone facing gender digital hate and harassment do to try to build their safety in online spaces?
You know, for people who don't want to have a big platform or anything, just for fun, I think social media is and should be a space where they feel free to be themselves, they have fun, they connect with other people. I think that's the base of social media. And so if this implies having perpetrators and abusers on there, then of course the first step is to, as we do, report and block. But then it also comes to the fact that sometimes this online misogyny can create a threat for physical reality. So of course, then there are steps to be taken to either, if it's in high school or in college, to report to your principal and people who are responsible for that. But we also know that it's not always taken seriously, because it's not, in brackets, it's not physical, it's not real. Just discussing it with people and seeing that you're not alone, and continuing to even maybe go to the police if it comes to that, reaching out to other people is always a good idea. But if you also witness it, then you absolutely have to act on it, and not in a way that makes you
threaten your physical safety.
Yeah,
or...
you got to be careful. But I think it's really important that people take a stand on this and say, you know what, that's not okay, or report these people, not take part of it, obviously.
It's so important for, you know, bystanders to be active, not just passive bystanders, whether that is in the physical world where it's harassment on people in the street, where it's important to intervene. The same is true for, you know, the online world.
Speaking of bystander action, what do you think about the role of men and boys in making digital spaces safer?
Yeah, that's so important, actually, I think, to include men in the discussion, because a lot of time we think, for example, with sexual violence, domestic violence, we think this is a women's problem. And, you know, when we look at the perpetrators, it's actually men who are perpetrating this form of abuse. In the same way, we are seeing that also with digital hate. The main perpetrators are men. And I think this is not a women's problem. I think this is a problem of, you know, men having a certain position in society and deciding, because we know that there are a lot of good men, minority of bad men, who are perpetrating that. But the good men, I think, should be able, you know, to call out when they see something, or when they read something online. They have such an important voice, because as women, cannot, you know, just take the burden on us. And it also, unfortunately, does not have the same impact that men can have on their male colleagues or friends, you know.
Yeah,
so
that is very true.
The standards and the ideals of what it means to be a man, we identify this with strength and leadership. And I think it's about redefining what is strength, actually. Is it just about what you're lifting at the gym? No, actually, you know, I think a big part of strength is having the emotional courage to denounce injustices. When we see, we're talking about all these different forms of men who are leaders in their fields. Well, I think it's about also redefining what it means to be a leader. Yeah. A leader is just not to be passive when they have injustices in front of them. I think it's about redefining what it means to be a man. Men who are staying, unfortunately, in this, you know, confine of patriarchy, of this standard idealized way of being a man, not only suffer from it, but also could actually benefit from growing as a man and, you know, just redefining what it means to be a man.
It doesn't affect me personally, so why should I do something about it? It just goes to show your values. And like, we live in a society, we actually have to care about others. I don't want to come back to like, you never know when you're going to need people, because that should be just a selfless act. But still, if you were in that situation, and I'm going to quote a philosopher, but it comes to John Rawls, and he had this idea of the veil of ignorance, which is that you have to be able to put yourself in a position where, what if you were living this situation? What if you didn't have the privileges that you have, the situation that you have? How would you want someone else to act towards you?
You know, some of the most misogynistic comments that we receive are actually from fathers who, when we click on their profile, have five beautiful daughters, have a wife that they've been married for, you know, 20 years. Is this man, when he is with, you know, some of his boys, are they still, you know, upholding these different misogynist joke that he's making? Because what if that was your daughter that was treated like that? Yeah. What if that was your wife that was treated like that, or your sister? Unfortunately, I don't think we would need people to relate directly, to take part in the change. But I think it's a good way concretely to identify if that was to happen to someone that you love close to you, would you tolerate that? Would you accept that? And would you want other men to also intervene and to denounce that it's not okay? You know, to see that some of these men have daughters, have wives, it's just heartbreaking to see, you know, and we can't imagine probably what goes beyond closed doors.
I'm just thinking about the kinds of harmful comments that some of your videos must get. I imagine it very much falls into the realm of bold and vocal toxic masculinity.
It's such a wide range. We're activists, we discuss social justice and women's rights, so it's mainly about this, but we see comments on almost, I mean, I don't think we've ever had a video where there hasn't been
hate speech
and misogyny online. I mean, it's really, honestly, I was going to say rare, but I don't think ever it's happened. For example, like we have these videos, especially I got to say when there's issues about relationships, and we talk sometimes about like equitable relationships and how to, you know, be a good, for example, boyfriend, or how to not perpetrate misogyny in your relationship. For example, there was this video recently that we posted about the so-called husband stitch that happens after women go through labor, and then the husband just jokes about having his wife's, you know, stitched tighter, which is just horrifying. And there has been real experiences of these, but also that people joke about this. We were shocked, and so we posted this video, and so many men and fathers and husbands, like Flo was saying, come and are like, you can't take a joke, or divorce happens because of women like you who can't take a joke, and continuing these
dangerous ideologies.
Exactly.
I think, as Emma was saying, we are targeted primarily because we discuss gender inequalities. And that's just a reminder of why we still, you know, need feminism till today. And I think it's a big part of why we are so invested in this is demonstrating that we have all these different inequalities that are still happening. To be honest, like I'm trying to reflect if there is one particular post. It's always there.
Yeah.
It's pervasive. And unfortunately, it's like, you know, I guess the demographic is it's mostly men. Like we do have some women who unfortunately
mostly
take...
Mostly cis men, yeah.
Yeah, cis men and cis white women, I guess, mm-hmm. mostly who would, you know, take part in these ideologies.
Yeah.
But when we look at cis men, it's across all the different ages, like whether that is 8 mm-hmm. years old, 70 years old men.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's... And from everywhere, whether
from
that
any
is
generation,
in,
it's really yeah. and it's really shocking to see that there's a lot of young boys as well, like really young, who comment horrible things that I can't. I'm not even gonna repeat because it's honestly very disturbing. And they're so young, and it comes back to the fact that we have to start teaching so early on in childhood, you know, to break these stereotypes, to break these roles that they have in their minds, that women do this, men do this, all of that. I think it's so important.
So healthy romantic relationship content seems to trigger special backlash on your channels. So related to that, we often speak to online behavior that's harmful in platforms like Instagram and Facebook. But I'm curious about the gendered abuse and harassment in dating apps.
The dating apps, they're all about, you know, yes, of course, helping you find your match, but also making money, right? So their priority is not to make it a safe space necessarily. Yes, there is, for example, Bumble, which is, I think that the woman has to be the one writing first, but still, I mean, it's one step, but it's not necessarily creating really these safe spaces, because once you're in contact with the other person, then it's just in. You know, someone can just be harassing and then they're reported, their account is taken down, boom, the next day they create a new account, like nothing happened. There's no like follow-up, like concretely to really erase these abusers and perpetrators from these sites. It's so easy to just see people as products because we're just swiping through people. So there is also this sense of, I'm not really talking to a real human being. So hate and violence can be perpetrated so much more easily. They're just a picture. They're just there. I can write anything and then unmatch them.
And the way we can make a link between dating apps and, you know, digital hate is that, you know, what happens when women and girls say no? their boundaries oftentimes are just not respected. What happens when they say no, whether that is when they are engaging with their partners and say no to have sex, or whether that is they do not want to go on a date with this person. And unfortunately, even though they block or they say no, well, they will still find them on Facebook, or they will still, you know, text message them. Just a reminder that, unfortunately, there is still so much work to be done to protect and to enhance women's safety.
What do you feel needs to change in a bigger systemic way in digital spaces?
These platforms, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, all of that, Twitter, now called X, I believe, they have such a big responsibility. And, you know, we said earlier that for us, social media is, we see it, we try to see it in a positive light, at least. But I know for these companies, it is mostly, if not all, about capitalism, of course. But they still have, and as we said, as leaders, they must take action. They must enhance these spaces because, I mean, if it continues just like just as it is right now, there isn't going to be any improvement. And I think they're the ones creating these spaces. So they're the ones that have to also regulate these spaces. They don't necessarily, I'm not going to say care, but they don't necessarily see it as such an important issue that they don't necessarily put a lot of money towards, you know, funding, for example, specific teams who only do, you know, they look at all the harassment every day or, you know, to create new algorithms or all of that. It's just not a top priority for them. And I think it should be.
Online violence against women and girls infringes on human rights and liberty. And I think they have a responsibility as corporations, as big companies, to actually, you know, create stronger regulation around that. And to, as Emma was saying, you know, offer trainings to their different teams and to actually amplify the voices of, you know, creators who are more marginalized. And this is, as Emma was saying, not a priority at the moment for them.
Yeah. And I think individually, then again, we have to continue to care for one another. I think that's such a cliche thing to say, but at the same time, we have to, as a society, keep building up each other and seeing that, yes, of course, we want free speech on social media and we want to people to be able to express their opinions and all of that, but also do it in a respectful way is such a basic thing to think about, but so many people don't do it because it's so easy. You're just behind your computer, you're just behind your cell phone, you don't even have to have a picture on your profile and you can just create these harmful conversations. And then also there's like the governmental side and the laws, which I know in Canada, we have some laws for cyber violence. In theory, of course, it's okay. It's great. You know, it encompasses the sharing of intimate pictures and it's, you know, all of that. But it people still feel like it's so vague. So, you know, the big platforms have to do something. Laws need to be a little more accessible. People in their daily lives have to continue working to be active bystanders and all of that. When we address these issues online and when we talk about them and when we discuss them in public spaces, this will create more conversations and will continue to create change. And so I think that's really why we have a platform also.
You know, we're so grateful to just be here today and to be able to talk about that with you because, yes, from our own lived experience, this is terrible what we are receiving. You know, the harm from online gender-based violence is severe. But I think it also, it's just a reminder of, you know, the importance of having this discussion because it's not just about what is happening online. This goes back to gender-based violence. Online is just one part of this spectrum of violence that is still happening. Through online violence, there is this issue about self-censoring women and that create a constant restriction on women's ability to just be free and live, you know, free from violence. And I think it's just so important that we have this discussion today because it reminds us that women and girls are not free from violence still.
All right, now what? Check out the CIS on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, YouTube, and more at The CIS Official. Get the facts on gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on CanadianWomen.org. While you're there, Read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show notes to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for your tireless support.
Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.